Just to start today, I thought what do I want to do? You know, I always talk about in the heroic journey, there's a moment, there's a transitional moment sort of right after the first part of the middle build, which is sort of a plunge into chaos and the abyss. And it's always difficult to talk about that abstractly because, you know, when we are living in a homeostatic kind of way, it's hard to recall, and I think this is for a reason, it's hard to recall our most challenging moments in our lives when we really started to go to the edge and start to believe that things might be lost, that things are really just sort of getting to a place that is so fully incomprehensible to sort and make sense of. So it's very hard to discuss that without a very clear example. And I think anyone in North America and probably around the world right now is starting to seriously understand the concept of chaos. I know I am, and it's terrifying. And it's terrifying on many, many different levels. But, you know, over the past, you know, what is it, 12 weeks, 13 weeks? This is the 12th week. And things are escalating and progressively getting far more complicated with each and every passing day. This notion of chaos is becoming more and more clear to me. And just recently, I had to say to myself, well, what do you do? What bullshit have I been telling people to do in these moments of chaotic dissolution and randomness? And so I went back to the principles that I talked about in the Big Idea Nonfiction seminar. And for those of you who haven't taken it, it's not necessary to take it to understand what I'm talking about. So when you enter this third quadrant of a story, remember, this is an arc, right? It's a heroic journey. And we're all heroes right now, whether we want to be or not. We are hitting this moment that the Greeks called Kairos, which is a seminal moment in the species. So this is species-wide, and every single person on this planet is playing inside the realm of the heroic journey. So I think that right now the stage that we've reached is this moment of fragmentation and chaos. So what is recommended by complex systems theories analysis, scientific ideas, is that when you hit these places, This is a place where the emergence of the novel arises. And the emergence of the novel is a new thing, something that can emerge, that can integrate the past in a way, in a novel way. And it's extraordinarily painful and difficult to get moving. All right, so how do you help the emergence of a new thing that's better than what came before? And so according to the complex systems theory, what you need to is to grab a hold of something very, very fundamental to your own being. The thing that you can really say, well, if it all goes south, I'm going to hold on to this thing. And if I get sucked into the vortex and I can't surface, at least I'll hold on to something valuable to me personally. Now, obviously, these are the things that we think of when we think of family, when we think of home, and we think of our brothers and sisters that we care about. We hold on to them tightly. So we hold on to our kids, and we hold on. I'll be right back. Okay, so we hold on to those we care about. And that's great, but we don't want to sit in a cave and hold on to our loved ones and wait for impending stuff that we can't control. So what do you do beyond that? And I go back to this guy named Paul Tillich. And he was a philosopher who really contended with a lot of deep issues. And his idea is primary concern. What's your primary concern? What is the thing, your vocation? What is the thing that intellectually you feel grounded? What is the thing that gives you insight, the thing that gives you moments of flow? It makes you feel better. And for me, and I think for everyone here on this call, I think it's storytelling. I think it's, you know, when shit hits the fan and I, you know, I just sit down and I start writing something, whether or not it means anything or goes anywhere, and I start clipping along and I do a little work. Maybe I do some spreadsheet work, or I do an analysis of a scene. I start to feel better. I start to feel like, yeah, you know, oh, that's an insight. That's something I never saw before. So in these moments of chaos, I think, you know, let's grab our primary concern. Let's not be compelled by outside forces telling us what we need to do in order to justify our humanity. Let's just focus on our primary concern, and let's consider some masterworks that maybe we should, that have been ignored, that are so beautiful and important that we need to really, pull those in. Let's hold on. Let's grab on to, you know, as a scientist with a scientific background, I know every single one of us shared 99.9% of the DNA code. You know, it's 0.1% that separates us. And 99.9% holds us together. And we need to focus on that stuff. And we need to find those people who've talked about their experience that we can relate to and empathize with. Because storytelling is all about empathy. It's all about jumping into other people's, through a process of self-examination, opening up our cognitive capacities to empathize and sympathize with other people. So that's kind of where I am on this. And it's what I'm going to hold on to when I'm feeling a lot of push and pull to get in line, or to speak out, or to do things that I still haven't figured it out, right? I haven't made sense of it all. I don't think anyone has. And so it's easy to jump in and say, well, that makes sense. I'm jumping onto that, and that's what I'm going to do. But that is a recipe for disaster when you don't do the work necessary to self-examine to your core, to come up with your moral landscape. Where's my moral landscape, and where do I sit on it right now? So my moral landscape is this. I believe that we are all agents inside a grand arena, and we all have agency. And it's our requirement to respect every other agent in the arena. And it doesn't mean that they have to comply with what we think, But it means that they have to respect us. And it means that they have to empathize with us, and we have to empathize with them. And that's what I'm holding on to. And our global pursuit is to discover something more about this the universe and world that we didn't know yesterday. So that's a pretty good start, I think. And so with that said, I know we're going to get into questions, but I do want to review just the kind of stuff that I pulled out of this week's scene. These are not the correct answers to the analysis. These are my answers to the analysis. I always say that, but I think it's worth repeating all the time that I am not the oracle. I am not the one voice of truth. I am just a struggling story lover out there in the universe trying to cling to things that make sense to me. So this is one of my favorite scenes of all time for a number of reasons. It's brilliantly crafted. It's extraordinarily specific. It's condensed. And it's so in keeping with the narrative device of this story, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. It's testimony. The way I look at the point of view and the narrative device of this story is this is someone giving testimony. In all the ways that you do give testimony, right? Like we give testimony when we're in a church, any church. We give testimony when we're in a court of law, right? We give our truth. And the beauty of this passage is it's extraordinarily condensed and so specific, but and not cliche. There's no bullshit here. There's no fake emotional stuff to manipulate you. It's almost very much like those old 1960s cop shows, you know, just the facts. And it's brilliantly presented. So here's, I'm just going to read my answers to our the things that I cling to, which are these core questions, these fundamentals, these first principles of story grid methodology that help ground me in understanding a greater appreciation of someone's craft as a storyteller. All right, so what these four Socratic questions are, what are the characters in the scene literally doing? That is, what are their micro on the ground actions? And the answer I had to that for this scene is the narrator tells her audience about the importance of her home and how it comforts and how its comforts were extraordinarily vulnerable. So this is her testimony about the importance of her home and how vulnerable that home was. And right there, we all understand. We all have a home, and we all know how vulnerable it is. So she locks us in just on her action on the ground answer to that question. All right, the second question is, what is the essential tactic of the characters? That is, what macro behaviors are they employing that are linked to a universal human value? Okay, so this is what I have for that. The narrator is using classic Enlightenment tools, which are ethos, logos, and pathos, to shine a light on injustice. So she's using the tools that came out of the grand philosophers of thousands of years ago and were sort of blown out a little bit by the Enlightenment and the scientific method of logical, reasonable, first principle thinking. So she's using that as a tactic that will explain a universal human value that we must understand. All right, third question. What universal human values have changed for one or more characters in the scene? Which one of those value changes is most important and should be recorded in our story grid spreadsheet? So what I came up with is safe, too threatened, to always vulnerable. Safe to threaten to always vulnerable. And again, the condensed, this is a poem, you know. Maya Angelou was a poet, and her prose was so perfectly condensed that she was able to, in this very short scene, embody this universal human value from safe to threatened to always vulnerable, right? This is a series of emotional movements that we all experience all the time. One minute we're safe, then we're threatened. And then we realize, holy shit, we're always vulnerable. There's no moment we can let our guard down. Never. The fourth, what is the story event that sums up the scene's on-the-ground actions, essential tactics, and value change? We will enter that event in the story grid spreadsheet. So what I wrote here is, one evening, a pale writer arrives at the home of innocence and reminds them of an imminent attack from tyrannical forces on the other side of town. And that's kind of what happens here. It's a pale writer she uses a man on a horse because it probably was true. And it's also metaphorically and thematically akin to the pale writer in the Bible. Brilliant. Okay, let's go through how I came up with my five commandments. I said the inciting incident was darkness begins to fall. So evening is coming. The progressive complication is chores. You know, we got to do our chores to keep our house in order. So Maya and her brother are out feeding the pigs because those are the chores that they have to do to keep the house in order. The turning point progressive complication is Mr. Stewart arrives on his horse and warns of the boys coming over to their house later. The crisis. Does the family abandon their home or remain to face the impending attack? And the climax is that the family hides the most vulnerable member of the family and braces for impact, heroically standing their ground. And the resolution is the worst. The resolution is the attack remains in the offing. It's going to come, just not tonight, but it's there. It's always going to be there. And my wife and I always talk about this research, this psychological research about people who were possibly in need of a colostomy operation, right? So people who were sick were brought into the psychologist's office, and they were saying, look, there's a possibility that you may need an operation and you might need a colostomy bag, and we're not really sure yet. And they brought in a whole slew of people, and they tracked their emotional well-being over a period of time. And what they discovered is that those people who were always unsure, who didn't know whether the operation were coming, were always fragmentally emotionally unstable. It made them feel very, very insecure. Well, those who did get the operation and had the bag, they got used to the bag, and their emotions started to rise. So the conclusions from this experiment were that the anticipation of a negative event is so anxiety producing that it can really just devastate your emotional well-being. And it's better to, it's almost like, let's get this over with, rip the Band-Aid off, right? We all have that impulse when we have a sore and we got to take a Band-Aid off, just rip it off fast, right? Because we want to experience that pain as quickly as possible, metabolize it, and move forward. So here we have a story where the ending is, hey, you're just going to have to live with this anxiety for who knows how long. So this is a remarkable work of art that embodies and presents that experiment that I just talked about with the specificity of a very particular time and place. And it's stunning, remarkable, and beautiful. All of those things. So that's what I can say about that. So let's move, Valerie, let's move now on to the questions, and I'll try and answer them without going into 28-minute diatribes.
Oh, we like your 28-minute diatribes.
Oh, thank you.
All right, so the first question comes from Anne. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and it feels especially relevant now. Should we be identifying characters by race or ethnicity in our books? It feels complicit to say characters black or Asian while not also identifying white characters as white. Should we leave race and ethnicity out altogether? Should we use dialogue or backstory to suggest? Wondering how others are grappling with this topic and what Sean in particular has seen happening in the publishing industry around this.
Well, it's a complex phenomenon, right? So obviously, I think everybody knows how I'm going to answer this. It's a requirement of the creator to self-examine, make choices that they deem are necessary and important to tell the best story. So I can't give you the Story Grid Institute's recommendations for proper pronoun usage, nor would I ever wish to. I do not believe, I would probably die for this idea, I do not believe we need to, that we should ever compel speech. And that part of living in a free society requires us to live in difficult and engage with things that we don't like. And where I fundamentally draw my line is respect. Are we respectful of another person's humanity? Or because there's no other person on the planet like anyone else. And that, I don't know whether anyone believes they're God or not. To me, that's God. That's like incredible. That's amazing. So this is sort of one of the fundamental things that I think everyone, if we had to sort of like chart a moral landscape, people would be like, you know what? We got to respect the individual. Every human being is sacred. Every human being has something that someone else doesn't have. And it's the sum total of all those beautiful idiosyncrasies that can really solve all of our problems. So when you're writing a story and you're not sure whether or not to refer to someone's race, it really depends on the story. I know Orwell chose to write science fiction and allegory and fantasy because these questions were just so, they're so raw right now that, and I think they were raw back then. So when he wrote 1984 and when he wrote Animal Farm, and he decided to make the world in which he discussed these issues be extraordinarily alien to the world that we seemingly live in now. That's a solution. And I think when you abstract, this is one of my favorite stories of all time is Dr. Seuss's Starred-Bellied Sneetches, the Sneetches. Because abstractly, if you, in fact, maybe I should, use that as, I think I will, for one of our sprints, just to make sure everybody just sort of focuses on it a little bit, because it's hilarious, it's beautiful, it's the human comedy. We can't help but laugh at these stupid animals. And it is, oh my gosh, is it poignant and to the point in a way that is just so brilliant. So Dr. Seuss used this really great idea to explain, and he also wrote the Butter Battle War or whatever. So many wonderful stories that he created. Anyway, whether or not you refer to somebody's skin color in the story, I can't tell you what to do. I think if you're writing a story like I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, you've got to. you just have to. So what the publishing industry at large is coming to a reckoning that really drove me out of it 20 years ago. I always put forward that the work was what's important. The hierarchy of growth is what I think that's what I personally always go to whenever I get confused. So the hierarchy of growth is about getting a little bit better at your craft and not worrying so much about where you sit on the power hierarchy. And I think the ideal sort of situation is that is when push comes to shove and a decision has to be made about whether or not to offer contracts, we just rely upon the work. And the problem with the industry that I immediately recognized when I got into it in 1992 was that there was no objective determination of what constitutes craft in a story. So that's how I created the Story Grid. I'm trying to objectively use science and story structure from the beginning of time, essentially, to try and come up with a means by which we can abstractly look at a story such that it's cross-culturally appealing. It's like, does this thing work? Does this work for everyone? How can we make it work? And so, so the growth hierarchy is what I wholly substantially believe in. That's why I talk about the process. Put the result away. Let's talk about process. Let's help each other. Everybody's welcome. And I think when you're writing a story and whether or not you make a decision about, I would highly recommend that you try and tell a simple story right now and try and deal with human beings and leave the physical descriptions as nebulous as you can. Because that way, you can really focus on the structural movement of the story as opposed to this very raw moment in time when we're all unsure about what the hell to do. And I don't think really high-pitched, screaming rhetoric about what everybody must do right now in this moment is called for. I think it's about self-examination. So sorry to not be able to give you the Department of Language official guide to pronouns. And, sorry, can't do it.
Okay, a real craft question for you now from Christy. She asks, can you explain your current thinking about middle build one and middle build two?
Sure. Pretty simple. I think I led with that, which is middle build two. I'm sorry, middle build one is the moment when the character is using the procedures that they've always used in the past to her advantage, her best advantage. So she thinks that employing all of the tools and all the tricks that she has from her previous, from her full worldview is going to work. And what she discovers in middle build one is that she exhausts that shit pretty quickly. And holy crap, what do I do now? I've got all of my tricks and I've blown them all out. And that's the end of middle build one. And then we go into the deep dark fall, into the chaotic randomness of not knowing what to do when faced with unexpected events that seemingly are coming at random and you have no time to process or metabolize. And middle build two is about sort of falling down that hole, reaching an all is lost moment. For Clarice Starling, it's when she, you know, she's basically kicked off the case and, you know, she's insulted. People are telling her, yeah, go back to the academy. We'll take it from here, you stupid idiot. Get out of here. And it doesn't make any sense to her because in middle build one, she had done all this incredible stuff to actually get to the place where they might be able to find the killer. And then they're like, get the hell out of here. We'll take it from here. And so it didn't make sense to her because she thought the FBI was a meritocracy. She thought that those people who do the best work rise. And what she discovered right in that middle build break is, oh, no, 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 no. This is a power hierarchy primarily. So power hierarchies, remember, power hierarchies are all about those persons at the top forcing those beneath them to stay in line. They are protecting their power base and they refuse to yield power. They have no interest in a meritocracy. So what they do is they try and get people to believe in meritocracy so that they can exploit their intellectual gifts and skills. So they take the gifts from the meritocratic thinkers and then they push them down into the vortex and say, shut your mouth, get in line, you serve me, I'm at the top. And that's what she experiences in that middle build too. So thematically, the middle build too is coming to the reckoning of the way things are, right? That you are powerless against the forces of the universe that are intent on keeping you in your place. And that's an all is lost moment. When we realize it's this moment metaphysically when it's almost like a bad LSD trip, right? I've never taken LSD, but this is what I've read, or psilocybin, but I don't have anything against it. I've just never done it. But apparently there's something when you approach this sort of noumenal space, which I think ayahuasca and LSD gets you to, the noumenal space is the unknowable, right? I talk about it all the time. Like there's things that we're just never going to know. So the unknowable noumenal space, when you have a bad acid trip, instead of feeling awe and a sense of wonder, you have terror. You feel extraordinarily meaningless. So it's this paradox, right? It's the yin and the yang of our experience. We can approach the mysteries of the universe as wondrous, incredible beauty, or it's freaking terrifying because it just reminds us of how tiny, tiny little speck of dust we are in the grand scheme of things. So this middle build too is the moment in which the character comes face to face with that fucking terror. I'm meaningless. I amount to shit. And I'm always going to be dominated by a power hierarchy that the chances of me beating the shit out of that power hierarchy and making the world a growth hierarchy are one in a gazillion. I'm just not going to do it, right? So that middle build too is this moment of realization of what you're fucking up against in this world. It's no joke. Okay then. And this is the moment when we start to climb out of that pit and we say to ourselves, well, fuck, okay. Let's say I'm meaningless in the grand scheme of things. What can I do to give myself some meaning? What can I do for me that will make me feel like I went down swinging? I'm not just some fucking tool. I went down swinging. I gave it my best shot. It's Luke standing up and fighting and telling Dragline, you got to kill me. I'm going to stand up. You're either going to kill me or you're going to walk away and I'm going to keep fighting. So that's what you have to do. So that's the end of the middle build. And that's what Clarice Starling comes to. Like, fuck it, man. Fuck the FBI. Somebody's going to die if I don't do something. I'm going to take some actions. And she does. And she heroically faces down that horrific realization that one of us is seemingly powerless. But it's from the powerless that wonderful, novel things emerge, right? So in the chaos comes novel things. And a story in that third chunk is about the emergence of novelty. It's a new cognitive framing. The character no longer thinks and believes the bullshit they used to think. Instead, they're like, I'm going to blow up all that bullshit that I think, and I'm going to move forward in this world, and I'm going to attune myself to the realities of my situation, and I'm going to react moment by moment as they come to me. Not only that, it's a perspectival shift, right? Not only am I going to do that, I am going to recognize that I am not the savior, that I can't do it by myself, that I need to participate with other people who care about the same shit I do in such a way that we can affect change. So this is like the fourth quadrant. The ending payoff of Tim's novel is when Jesse relinquishes her all-powerful Jessiness. And instead, she moves and she works with someone who's committed to the same thing she is, which is her enemy, Az. And together, they start to attune themselves to the moment-by-moment reality of what they're facing in the threshing. No, they're like Michael Jordan. They're not thinking about shots that they haven't taken yet. Right? That's a famous Michael Jordan quote, which I think is brilliant. Somebody said, don't you worry about, you know, missing? And he said, why the hell would I worry about a shot that I haven't taken yet? Damn right. Why am I going to worry about something that I haven't done yet? I'm going to prepare to take the shot. And when the moment arises, I take the shot. Simple as that. That's called attunement to reality. This is why we have these amazing professional athletes who are so attuned to the moment and the reality that they do magical things because they are absolutely attuned to the moment. They enter some sort of time-space continuum, and they know the shot's going to go through the net before they even take it. And that's why they have a difficult time after they've left professional sports, because they've actualized and they don't know how to shift domain. Anyway, that's my middle build one, middle build two thing.
Okay, we've got two questions here that are sort of in the same vein. Megan is asking about the spacing of the five commandments at the scene level. Specifically, should that turning point progressive complication come at the midpoint or halfway through? And Owen is kind of asking something similar, but at the act level. And he wants to know about any rules of thumb about how quickly a writer needs to get to the end of the book after the climax. So could you talk a little bit about the spacing of the five commandments and whether there's any rules of thumb about how we need to use those or how we should approach them?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good rule of thumb to structure the five commandments in sort of a progression that, you know, you have your inciting incident, and then you have a couple of progressive complications that move to a turning point, which shifts the value. So let me speak of it instead of the five commandment terminology, sort of speak of it in terms of the cognitive processing that we all do all the time. So the inciting incident corresponds to some kind of stimulus that we intuit in our environment. So right now I'm sitting at my desk, I'm looking out the window, there's a road in front of me, there's a big field, and if somebody walked by naked, that would incite me, right? So, all right, so the incitement would be, oh my God, there's a naked person in front of my gate. I'm on my Zoom call. How am I gonna process this, right? So progressive complications ensue. So I have to process the phenomena of a naked person, and I have to make sense of their behavior in order to evaluate how to act, right? Okay, so they're naked. Okay, what does that mean? Well, if they're desperately clanging on my gate, right, that's going to be a progressive complication, which says, shit, this person needs my help if they're banging on the gate, right? And if they're banging on the gate, maybe that rises the crisis of, you know what, Zoom people, I gotta go. And then the crisis is, if I leave the Zoom call, I'll disappoint everybody on the call. Or if I don't leave the Zoom call, the poor naked person may be, you know, be running from an attacker. Right? So we have a best bad choice there. And the value shift has moved that turning point progressive complication, her or him banging on my gate, says the value has shifted. That person is intent upon invading my domain, my world, right? So if I don't do something, so I've moved from protected to threatened in a flash. So that's a turning point progressive complication because it shifts the universal value, which raises the crisis. The crisis is, do I go deal with the naked person banging on my gate, or do I ignore them because I've got a really good lock on it and there's no fucking way they're getting in? So my action from that point would move forward where I either leave the Zoom call or I don't. And then the resolution is, something like, I leave the call, I give them shelter, I come back and I say, hey, I've got to cancel this call, the end. That resolves the Zoom meeting. And all of you were like, geez, I wonder what happened with that naked person at Sean's gate. Or I ignore it and you never know. You never know that there was a naked person at my gate banging for entry. And you don't know that I'm just a jerk who doesn't lend help to somebody. So any way you structure the movement of those five commandments is kind of interesting, right? And you've got a million options to come up with. So when you think of your scenes and you think of five commandments, it's often good to move away from the terminology of inciting incident, progressive, and think about things like, what would be something that could happen that would be unexpected for this character in this moment? Oh, a bomb goes off. Oh, okay, let me do that. I don't like that. Let me try something else. So in terms of the progression, to make it an equal five-part situation, yeah, that's okay as a rule of thumb. But what you're going to discover is usually once you hit that TP, that turning point progressive complication, then the velocity starts to really move. Because what nobody likes is uncertainty, right? So what people don't like to sit with is, wow, I don't know whether or not I should do something or not. Let me sit with this feeling of anxiety about not knowing what to do for a while. No one likes that. We all want to, let me get rid of this shit as fast as I can, right? So that's why you have the spinning of action and behavior based upon these quick value shifts. So if you find yourself sort of dragging out the deliberations of a crisis, I would recommend to take a hard look at that because I don't think it's the way people behave. People want to get to certainty. Oh, if I can just get this naked guy out of my yard, everything will be fine. That will give me certainty. How can I get that result? Let me cause that effect by telling them to get the hell out of my yard, right? That would be an action I could take. So when you start sort of like doing percentages of how long I should be doing this and that, I think you can start becoming paralyzed by your own intellectual capability. And when that happens, I suggest just start playing around. You know, just start thinking about crazy things about naked people in your yard. And then that will engage you. And then you'll stop worrying so much about the technical abilities of being able to string out a TP, turning point progressive complication. As for how to end a story, Owen's question, this is, this is again something that I always recommend people. There's a famous, I worked with a guy named Matthew Modine who was in a movie called Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick, right? And so he told me this story about Kubrick that I thought was fascinating. He said that, you know, when Modine got this part, he was a very young actor. He was very insecure. And so he just wanted the master to tell him what to do all the time because he was going to work with Stanley Kubrick and Stanley Kubrick is God, right? So he's so excited because he thought that he was just going to get this Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of relationship. And when he showed up on set, Kubrick never really gave him much direction. He would say, hey, try it again. You know, why don't you try it one more time with like this? And on top of that, he kept asking Modine's opinion about the third act. And he kept saying, so Matthew, do you think, what do you think about the ending? Do you think it works? And he's like, yeah, it definitely works. Yeah, yes, Mr. Kubrick, it works. So he kept saying that, and Kubrick kept asking him, Matthew, I still have to ask you this question. What do you think about the ending of the story? And finally, Modine started to think about it. And, you know, he started to really consider what Kubrick was trying to get across, because at the end of the movie, they sort of sing this really ridiculous Walt Disney song as they've, you know, burned down Vietnam, basically. And so eventually, Modine started to think about it in terms of the global story, and he started to think about what Kubrick was trying to get across with it. And so he kept asking Kubrick, he kept going back, well, what are you trying to do here? I think it works thematically in this way and that way. And they started to have this conversation, and it remained the way it was written. But Kubrick did that for a reason, so that the experiencer of the story and the person who was going to have to actually enact the story could self-evaluate the ending, right? So when you're writing the ending, you have to give into the understanding that there are going to be some people who don't think it's a very good ending. There are going to be some people who say, ah, you rushed it. I was really, you know, I really loved it up until they rushed and shit, you know, they screwed the pooch on the ending and it sucked. Okay, some people are going to feel that way. But you're going to know. Like, I didn't do the ending for the threshing. I just said, Tim, you got to fix the ending. And he did the ending, and I thought through it. I self-examined the ending from my point of view, not Tim's point of view. And I asked my question, what, Sean, do you think Tim was trying to get across here? And why did he do her sort of coming back from the dead in the way that he chose to do? Because it's kind of nebulous. You're not really sure what happened there. Was she in some kind of alternative state? Was she in a different realm? Was she literally talked to by 80s, you know? And I thought all of that, and I was like, you know what? I think it's cool. And for whatever reason, that's the way he wanted to end it. And to change it, I could have made it more clear to the reader. And it becomes a subjective interpretation of whether or not the questions that the ending brings up for the experiencer of the story are the questions that you want them to contemplate. So, you know, we're about to publish The Sand Sea, and people have been posting things on Goodreads. And, you know, you get the spectrum of value of people's reactions to the book. And my favorite comment of all comments is always, you know, this book could have been good if it had an editor. So as an editor, and having worked on the thing for 3.5 years, you can immediately plunge into, you know, making excuses. But they're entitled to that opinion, because everybody has their own vision of a story. So what I always feel good about is that if there are people saying, you know what, I really liked it and I want to know what happens next, or some people are like, I'm unsure, or I just didn't like it, it means that you're probably being very specific in your choices. So if everybody is in agreement that this is a perfect ending, you're probably not getting authentic reviews. So you're going to have a spectrum of value of reactions to your endings, and you're going to have to live with that uncertainty. But what you always have to go back to is, are you happy with the effect that the ending brings to people in their reviews and everything? And if you get a wide shift of analysis, I think that's a pretty good ending. Because what it means is each individual person who's reading the story is evaluating the ending through their own subjective experience and starting to self-examine what it means to them, which is good, because it's making them think about meaning. And that's what stories are about. They're making us self-examine what we think about our moral landscape. So when Maya Angelou wrote, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She could care less about what Sean Coyne thinks about it. But I think she would have been happy that it was meaningful to me. That's what she cared about, was getting people to self-examine through time. She's no longer on the planet, and here we are self-examining based upon her creation. That's a super-duper win for her. She's smiling. She's having the time of her existence because she changed the world such that people like us are considering her life experience and her story years after she's left. So you gotta sort of do your own check and say, does this ending feel, how does it feel? Does it feel like I'm happy with it? Yeah. Does it technically work? Does it follow the structure? Yes. Have I done the obligatory events that are required in this genre? Yes. Could I do it better? I don't think so. I think I like it the way it is. Then that's the sniff test and you're done. And then you bring in an editor and then maybe they can change your mind. But that's it. Yeah.
Okay, Alyssa has a question. I often take the hero's journey beats a little too literally. Can you give some examples of stories that have hit the beats in unexpected ways?
Well, I'm going to put forward shortly and within the next few months, sort of the story grid, my interpretation of the heroic journey. And it really is a super abstract version of the heroic journey. So I've intentionally tried to pull out language of the 1950s that sort of oppresses it in a way. The way I see the heroic journey is what I've been talking about for the past few months. I see the heroic journey as the means by which we open up our cognitive frame in order to open our ability to deal with complexity and the complex nature of our environment. So I believe that the monomythic heroic structure is actually the embedded process by which we are able to deal with the immense enormity of the noumenal space of our lives and reality in such a way that we can attune ourselves to the moment-by-moment beauty of unexpected life. So the heroic journey is about venturing into darkness, the unknown. One of the lenses I think we can use to look at masterworks is let's talk about I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and speak of it in terms of a heroic journey. It's a story of a young person coming of age to understand how to best navigate the world in a way that would be meaningful to her. And it requires her to go into many, many dark corners and to experience traumatic events that she brilliantly describes in it, again, in testimonial form. So even when she is taken advantage of and raped as a young girl, the means by which she tells that story is, it's from a woman with a great cognitive opening. And the beauty of the storytelling is that she admits to her own deficiencies, etc., but is also capable of seeing the beauty in her rapist in a way that is heartbreaking. So heroically, she moves from an innocent person who has never done anything but exist. She's cast out, right? She has to move from her father and mother's home to her grandmother's home in Arkansas. She was born in Los Angeles. Her parents, their marriage didn't make it. And she was literally put on a train by herself as a little girl, maybe four, with her brother who was maybe six, with a little note and their tickets pinned inside her brother's jacket saying, and a steward on the train shepherded them to like Bakersfield, and then they were on their own. And they had to stay on this train until they got to Arkansas, and then their grandmother picked them up. What a heroic journey, right? And there's these beautiful people on the train who take care of them. And it was the way this culture dealt with the cards they were dealt. Well, sometimes things happen for people like us. And for people like us, we trust one another that we can actually entrust our children to our group and they will take care of us. And it's a beautiful moment. And then she makes her way to Arkansas, and here she is. She was born in California, and now she's in Arkansas. And she has all of these domain shifts throughout the story. She has to go to St. Louis to be with her mother. That's when that really bad thing happens to her. And it's about midpoint, isn't it? About midpoint in the story. And then she opens up her framing and understands, you know, I'm not a victim. Something shitty happened to me, and that's life. And the end of this story is the birth of a beautiful boy, the birth of another life. And it's this heroic arc. And you know that boy at the end of this story, who's born to Maya Angelou, is going to benefit so extraordinarily by the power and the heroism of his mother that it's this beautiful moment. And she ends the story with the birth of her beautiful boy. And there we go. Now the cycle begins for her boy. And it's this beautiful, heroic journey. Now, does she have mentors? Does she have allies and enemies in this story? Yes. Does she have a meeting with the goddess? Sort of. It's not a literal meeting with the goddess. It's a meeting with the noumenal world. This very strange world of her rapist. It's not a pleasant world. But there is some pleasantries to it, too. She admits to that. She never felt coddled and helped and loved like she was in that moment. So the heroic journey is thematically these four stages. You know, you have your beginning hook, the ordinary world, and a transition into the extraordinary world. Now, when you're talking about a maturation story, it's about agency, right? It's about the character starting to be able to grasp agency. So Maya Angelou at the beginning of the story has zero agency. She's just a little girl and things happen to her and she reacts to them and she learns from them. And then she starts to be able to learn, oh, if I'm a good student in school, that's good for me. So I'll be a good student. And what do you know? I love reading. I love learning and I can do that. And so she gets some procedures in that first middle build, and then she hits that all is lost moment in the third quadrant, and then she has full fucking agency by the end of this book, and she goes out and she finds the father that she wants to have for her son and she gets him, and she's got full agency. So at the end of this story, you're like, yeah, she's gonna be okay. There's no one who's gonna keep her from finding meaning in life. She already found meaning and she's only 19 years old. So if you look at the heroic journey in these four quadrants and this idea of the opening up of our worldview, and then you impose these Jungian archetypical things and think about characters in terms of who's my mentor, who's my shapeshifter, right? And what's the purpose of a mentor? Oh, they're there to teach the character how to navigate the world, right? So anyway, there's going to be a lot more on this to come, but it's my goal to make the heroic journey less, you know, kind of, let me go take something from another thing, bring it back to the good people, and then everything will be great. And more about how do we open up our cognitive framing and have insights in such a way that we can integrate our lives so that we can deal with this complex world in such a way that we respect one another and we can all level up on the growth hierarchy and try and really, you know, diminish that power hierarchy stuff and make the power hierarchy a meritocracy. Like, let's look up to the people who have climbed the growth hierarchy. Like, let's look up to Miles Davis, you know, or whoever. You know, he might not have been the nicest guy in the world, but he was one of the greatest jazz artists of all time, right? So you don't sort of like say, I'll just behave like Miles Davis. No, you say, how did he grow? He practiced. He worked his ass off because nobody was going to give him shit. He had to be so much better than everybody else. And he was. That's someone to emulate. Okay, yeah, that's it. Yeah, we're past time, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to leave it. We've got a couple other questions, but we'll carry them over to next week. Thank you, Sean, so much for your time. Okay. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so
much. Stay strong.